Turn our Bibles to Nehemiah chapter 1 again this evening. Nehemiah chapter 1. We'll be studying chapter 2, but I want to go ahead and start us in chapter 1. And so follow along as I pick up reading. You remember that as we began the book of Nehemiah, we saw that chapter 1 began with a report. It was a report from Nehemiah's brother and some other men to Nehemiah about things that were going on in Jerusalem and in Judah. Beginning in Nehemiah chapter 1, verse 1. The words of Nehemiah, the son of Hakaliah. Now it happened in the month of Chislev, in the 20th year, while I was in Susa, the capital, that Hanani, one of my brothers, and some men from Judah came. And I asked them concerning the Jews who had escaped and had survived the captivity and about Jerusalem. And they said to me, the remnant there in the province who survived the captivity are in great distress and reproach, and the wall of Jerusalem is broken down and its gates are burned with fire. When I heard these words, I sat down and wept and mourned for days, and I was fasting and praying before the God of heaven. And I said, I beseech you, O Lord, O God of heaven, the great and awesome God, who preserves the covenant and loving kindness for those who love him and keep his commandments. Let your ear now be attentive and your eyes open to hear the prayer of your servant, which I am praying before you now day and night. On behalf of the sons of Israel, your servants, confessing the sins of the sons of Israel, which we have sinned against you. I and my father's house have sinned. We have acted very corruptly against you and have not kept the commandments, nor the statutes, nor the ordinances which you commanded your servant Moses. Remember the word which you commanded your servant Moses, saying, if you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the peoples. But if you return to me and keep my commandments and do them, though those of you who have been scattered were in the remotest part of the heavens, I will gather them from there and will bring them to the place where I have chosen to cause my name to dwell. They are your servants and your people, whom you redeemed by your great power and by your strong hands. O Lord, I beseech you, may your ear be attentive to the prayer of your servant, and the prayer of your servants who delight to rever your name, and make your servant successful today, and grant him compassion before this man. Now I was the cupbearer to the king. Nehemiah tells us here in chapter 1 that although that first group of Jews who had returned to Jerusalem after the Babylonian defeat and deportation in the 500s BC, although they had arrived in Jerusalem nearly 100 years before, Jerusalem, the city, was still largely in ruins. The temple had been rebuilt, but attempts to rebuild the city itself had been frustrated. Sometime less than 20 years before Nehemiah 1 took place, the walls of the city had been started to be rebuilt and apparently come close to being finished to some degree or another. Ezra 4 records that for us. However, by some political maneuvering done by Jerusalem's enemies, there had been an injunction then written by the king of Persia forcing the construction to halt. In fact, with royal support giving them a bully's courage, the surrounding provinces took the opportunity to rub Jerusalem's face in the mud just a little bit. They had marched on Jerusalem with the backing of the king of Persia, had flattened the walls of the city that had been started to rebuild, and then burnt the gates of the city. That's the situation, having happened perhaps 15, almost 20 years before. That's the situation that led to the report in Nehemiah 1. Not surprisingly, the colonists who had come back to Judah lost heart. We can understand that. All their hard work was destroyed. The king of Persia was against them. Their enemies are gloating over them, and God appears to be sleeping. What they didn't know, however, is far on the other side of the Persian Empire, 1,000 kilometers or more away, God was working to raise up just the right man at just the right time. God was preparing and placing a man who would be his man, God's man, for the job of rescuing Jerusalem from her shame. In fact, I believe the question that we are expected to ask as we read Nehemiah 1, we have to imagine we're coming to this book for the very first time, and we've never read it before, and we don't really know who Nehemiah is or what he's going to do. The question that we should be asking ourselves as we read the opening verses here are, well, who's this Nehemiah, son of Hilkiah guy, and how in the world can he do anything to rescue Jerusalem from their plight? He lives 1,000 kilometers away. What can a common, ordinary, run-of-the-mill Jew living in far-off Susa, what can he do to heal the sores and bind up the wounds of Jerusalem? Well, craftily, not until the very end of chapter 1, does Nehemiah reveal to you, the reader, that in fact he is not a common, ordinary, run-of-the-mill Jew living in Susa, far away. He in fact is a prominent official in the court of the king, in the court of the king of Persia himself. Chapter 1, verse 11, end of the verse, "Now I was the cupbearer to the king." God had prepared and placed Nehemiah in just the right position to help his people. You know, and God always seems to work that way, doesn't he? We can't see it. We don't know what his perfect strategies are. What seems to us unrelieved catastrophe suddenly turns into a beautiful plan brought together in the perfect wisdom and sovereignty of God. But God's plan, though we can't see it, it's there all along. His strategy is there all along, woven through the difficulties and troubles. The good hand of God is there working to accomplish his purposes. And in fact, that phrase, the good hand of God, is really the theme of Nehemiah chapter 2, our text for this evening. Notice verse 8 of that chapter. Right at the end of the verse, it says, "And the king granted the things I had requested to me, because the good hand of my God," says Nehemiah, "was on me." You see, Nehemiah was a man who was capable, he was opportunistic, and bold. But all through this chapter, time after time after time, Nehemiah reminds us that it is God's working that is the difference maker in every situation. Verse 18 of chapter 2. "I told them how the hand of my God had been favorable to me." Verse 20, "So I answered them and said to them, the God of heaven will give us success." Well, what I want to do this evening then is take that theme, the good hand of God, and make it the theme of this study because it's clearly by repetition the theme of chapter 2. In this chapter, we're going to see the good hand of God in two ways. We're going to see it in two ways. In the leader God gave, that's Nehemiah, of course, in the leader God gave, and then in the success God gave. So in the leader and in the success God gave. In those two things, we will see the good hand of God. This chapter will remind us that human excellence has a wonderful place in God's plan and God's working, but the real power is always found in divine omnipotence. It is always found in divine providence. It is always found in the good hand of God. And so let's start with the good hand of God in the leader he gave. And again, as you begin reading the book of Nehemiah, the problem is obvious. There is chaos reigning in the land of Judah. Nehemiah's concern for his people is noble and immediately captures our sympathy. We relate to Nehemiah and we appreciate his kind of shepherd's heart. But again, the insightful reader is asking, well, who is Nehemiah and what can he do about the problem? As one commentator said, Nehemiah has kept a surprise in store for the reader, who has so far no inkling of Nehemiah's position. Nehemiah, by God's design, could do something about a city 1,000 kilometers away. Why? He has the ear of the king of Persia. "I was the cupbearer of the king," he says at the end of chapter 1. Now, as we've noted previously, the term cupbearer was a title that had far more significance than just wine pourer. Nehemiah was decidedly not. He was definitely not one of those multitudes of nameless, faceless, silent servants who were merely table servers, furniture dusters, house servants, vacuumers, sweepers, whatever, in the king's palace. That's not what the term means. We know that for various reasons. Number one, the king of Persia would never, ever have spoken in this personal, familiar way with Nehemiah if he had just been kind of the guy who just keeps your cup topped up at the table. And he certainly would never have appointed a mere plebe, a mere wine taster kind of cup pourer sort of guy, to be the governor of one of his provinces. You don't pick the guy who's just, you know, you say you run a business here in Pretoria and you're out for dinner in one of our fine restaurants in the city, and you just turn to the guy who puts the plate in front of you and said, I think I'm going to put you over the Cape Town branch of my business. It's not the way you do things. And of course, there's plenty of evidence from the ancient Near East that the title cupbearer in the ancient world was reserved for a position of counselor and confidant of the king. You know, like, yeah, you know, in the British in the old days, they had like the warden of the wardrobe, you know, that kind of thing. You know, well, that person had a lot of influence, not just on, you know, what the king or the queen wore. Same sort of deal. Nehemiah is a royal minister, not a palace slave. He is in a position that today we would call on the cabinet. Right? He has that level of influence. And that's, of course, the first way that you see the good hand of God in this account, in the leader God gave. God has strategically placed Nehemiah. We don't know how it's all worked out, but like Daniel before him and Mordecai in the middle there, Nehemiah has come to this high place in the Persian Empire. And he is just in exactly the right position to serve as the rescuer of Jerusalem. Nehemiah is on the chessboard, and he's not really a pawn. He's more like a knight, you know? Not quite the king, but he can do more than the pawn. God had worked through the years in every success, in every advancement of Nehemiah's, until he was in just the right place at just the right time. Human excellence is important, and Nehemiah shows us a lot of human excellence in this book. But divine providence and omnipotence, that's always the determinative issue, isn't it? So, Nehemiah's position is the first way you see the good hand of God unveiled in the leader he gave. A second way we see that is in Nehemiah's passion. And we developed this last time from chapter 1, so I'll just mention it here. Nehemiah had, according to chapter 1, you saw it in his prayer there, a passion for God's glory. That's critical if you're going to be used of God. Nehemiah also had a passion for the welfare of others. He is not so bloated with pride, so self-consumed by the luxury and the power of his position in the Persian court that he has no concern for others anymore. Not at all. His heart is not so fattened by his personal success and the high pinnacle of success that he has reached that he cannot be concerned anymore for the lean and hungry brothers and sisters back in Judah. And God's good hand is seen in that as well. The passion or the character of the leader, the man that Nehemiah was. Now, a third way that God's good hand is seen in the leader that he gave is in Nehemiah's planning. And this leads us, of course, into chapter 2, the focus of our study this evening. According to the opening verse of chapter 1, Nehemiah received this report from Jerusalem about the distress of the people there in the month of Chislev, which would relate basically to our December. Chapter 2 gives a new time setting. Pay attention. It came about in the month Nisan in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes. So it's the same year of the king's reign. It is now the month Nisan. You say, well, what does that relate to? That would be the month April in our calendar. And so basically 4 months have passed. From the receiving of the report to the time we hit chapter 2, 4 months have passed. Now, let me be honest. For a man like Nehemiah, 4 months is an eternity. Right? This guy, you know, if you give me a long enough lever, I can move the world, the physicist said. If you give Nehemiah 4 months, it is unbelievable what he can organize the world. Well, what has he been doing? Before he starts organizing anything, he starts praying. We saw that in chapter 1. Verse 4, when I heard these words, I sat down and I wept and I mourned for days, and I was fasting and praying before the God of heaven. Nehemiah is well positioned. Nehemiah is powerful. Nehemiah has great personal wealth. Nehemiah is immensely capable. He's like King David, who I always describe as omnicompetent. Nehemiah is in the same category. In fact, David maybe is in second place. Nonetheless, in spite of all of those things being true, Nehemiah understood that prayer came before action. Prayer came before action. And so he starts in chapter 1 with prayer. And you say, is that all that Nehemiah did? Did he just pray and then sit back and wait for God to do something? No. Although totally dependent on prayer and on God, Nehemiah also understood there is no substitute for action. Later in this study, we'll call it dependent action. So Nehemiah prays, and Nehemiah plans to take action. And the truth is, he plans as excellently as he prays. You see, when the king started to ask Nehemiah questions in chapter 2 about how long would Nehemiah be gone if he went to Jerusalem and when would he return, it's interesting to note that Nehemiah has very specific answers to give him. He's not waffling around trying to come up with things off the top of his head. Nehemiah even had a list of things that he would need from the king: letters of introduction, permission to use certain raw materials, and so on. What Nehemiah had been doing in the 4 months between the report in chapter 1 and the royal interview of chapter 2 is pretty obvious. He's been praying and planning. He's researched the situation so that he can give a careful, thoughtful, purposeful answer to any of the king's questions. Nehemiah didn't come to King Artaxerxes with just a request. He came with a request and a plan that would make the request workable. In other words, this royal interview that we're going to read about here in chapter 2, it's not haphazard, it's not accidental, it's no spur-of-the-moment thing. It's not just some kind of off-the-cuff. The topic of Jerusalem didn't just happen to come up that day. And then Nehemiah fired off some ideas off the top of his head and just hoped God would kind of bring it all together. Well, you know, God did bring it all together, but it was not accidental, it was not haphazard at all. Notice one very important word in verse 11 of chapter 1. O Lord, I beseech you, may your ear be attentive to the prayer of your servant and the prayer of your servants, so others have been praying as well, who delight to rever or fear or worship your name, and make your servant successful today. That's the word. Today. Nehemiah had spent 4 months praying, 4 months planning, and then in verse 11, he asked God, give me success today before this man, the king. This is the prayer Nehemiah prays as he's standing outside the grand doors that enter into the king's throne room or wherever he was meeting the king that day. Before the doors open, Nehemiah stands there and he says, God, okay, I'm going to put it all on the line. I'm praying that you would give me success today. Today was the day that Nehemiah determined he would raise the issue of Jerusalem with King Artaxerxes. His preparations are done with all of the excellence possible. He is totally prayed up. It is now time to act. Chapter 2, verse 1. It came about in the month Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, that wine was before him, and I took up the wine and I gave it to the king. Now, I had not been sad in his presence. Now, it's interesting because we know from chapter 1 that for the past 4 months, Nehemiah has been mourning, he has been praying, he has been fasting, he has been consumed with a concern for the city of his fathers. However, he has been very careful not to give his employer, his boss, King Artaxerxes, any hint of the pain in his heart, and that's actually fairly normal. Kings tended to have a short way with whiny, weepy, depressed counselors. Right? They cut off their heads. I mean, they just didn't want him around. So Nehemiah has been very careful not to show that. This day is different. On this day, Nehemiah prays, walks in, and takes the calculated risk of letting his sorrow show. It is not an accident, it's not a performance, it's what he's been feeling for months, but this is a planned moment. And so gone are his springy step, his quick wit, his erect stature, whatever he was like. He seems to shuffle into the presence of the king, head bowed, face lined with care. And Artaxerxes picks up on it like that. This is definitely not the Nehemiah that he knows. The end of verse 1, "Now I had not been sad in his presence. So the king said to me, 'Why is your face sad, though you are not sick? This is nothing but sadness of heart.' Then I was very much afraid." Sometimes even when everything's going as planned, you're still afraid, aren't you? And so we see God's good hand here. First in the leader that God gave, that's Nehemiah. And now we're going to see it in here in chapter 2. Secondly, in the success that God gave. The success that God gave. What we're going to find in chapter 2 is not only does Nehemiah need to interact with the king, there are actually three groups of people before whom God made Nehemiah successful in this chapter. The first group is, well, the individual, it's the king, Nehemiah's boss, King Artaxerxes. "Why is your face sad, though you are not sick? This is just sadness of heart." Nehemiah says, "I was very afraid." You might think he's kind of a chicken, right? Nehemiah, fear is not something Nehemiah normally struggles with. I'm pretty confident in that. He knows full well the fickle nature of ancient Near Eastern monarchs. He works with this guy every day. And so he realized this could very well be the last moment of his life. I mean, his life expectancy could be like 3 seconds long right now. Proverbs 19, verse 12 says, "The king's wrath is like the roaring of a lion, but his favor is like dew on the grass." Nehemiah is not sure if he's going to get eaten or drenched. He just doesn't know. But divine omnipotence had given Nehemiah the moment that he had been praying for. Here's the opportunity, so he steps right in and takes his shot. Verse 3, "I said to the king, 'Let the king live forever.'" Which, of course, is a lot of nonsense, but it's what you had to say to the king. "Why should my face not be sad? Why should my face not be sad when the city, the place of my father's tombs, lies desolate and its gates have been consumed by fire?" You see, here's what's on my mind, King. Jerusalem, the city of my ancestors, it's on my mind. You say, okay, well, why would Nehemiah be so afraid to bring that up? Well, don't forget what I told you earlier. In Ezra chapter 4 is recorded a decree from this very king Artaxerxes, a decree that forbid any civil construction projects in Jerusalem. What's Nehemiah going to ask for? To do a civil construction project in Jerusalem. Her enemies had convinced the king of Persia that Jerusalem was a city of rebellion, and well, there was some validity to that. And rebuilding her walls would lead inevitably to a refusal to pay taxes and then a revolt. And so Nehemiah is afraid for his life, first of all, and secondly, he's afraid that all of his plans would be in vain because he's asking the king to change a pre-existing, long-established international policy. Make no mistake about it, that's what this is. He is asking the king to radically change a pre-existing, for at least 15 years, international policy. This is not just a personal plea. This is a request for a reversal of an established policy. Now you're starting to understand why Nehemiah is sweating bullets here. And so in verse 3, he outlines the problem to the king. He says, "Why should my face not be sad when the city, the place of my father's tombs, lies desolate and its gates have been consumed by fire?" Now, Artaxerxes had a lot of problems if you study history, but he's not a total moron. And so he knows the game. He knows the game. Nehemiah has not picked the king's shoulder to cry on for no reason. Because he just happens to be the nicest guy Nehemiah knows or something like that. People don't come to the king with their problems to get sympathy. You go to the king to get permission. Verse 4. The king said to me, "What would you request?" He knows that there's a request veiled behind this. "What would you request?" Nehemiah, "So I prayed to the God of heaven." This doesn't say so, but this surely must be the shortest prayer in the whole biblical record. I'm pretty sure that Nehemiah did not hear drop to his knees, recite five psalms, you know, confess sin for 20 minutes, go through 15 pages of his prayer journal, and end by singing four verses of Abide with Me. You know, I'm pretty sure that's not what's going on here. This is one of those bullet prayers. Help me, God. That's all there's time for. But as always, Nehemiah shows his genuine commitment to prayer before action. I mean, this man is a man of action, capital A. He might have an equal or two in the biblical account, but certainly no one excels him. He is a man of action, but Nehemiah is always praying. And you see it all over his book. Well, having with that bullet prayer done what he's been doing for the last 4 months, put the whole situation in God's hands, Nehemiah lays out his request. Verse 5. I said to the king, "If it please the king, and if your servant has found favor before you, send me to Judah, the city of my father's tombs, that I may rebuild it." Now notice immediately that when Nehemiah saw a problem, he didn't suggest sending someone else. I appreciate that about this guy. He's willing to contribute personally to the solution. We all have a bit of critic in our heart, don't we? That's something the critic in our heart can learn from. Never criticize without being willing to be part of the solution. And so Nehemiah points out there's a problem, but he says, "And I'm willing to be the solution to the problem. Send me." Now, the king knows that Nehemiah is fully capable of doing the job he has just asked that he be allowed to do. Knowing that, the king asks a few questions of his own. Verse 6, the king said to me, with the queen sitting beside him, "How long will your journey be, and when will you return?" So it pleased the king to send me, and I gave him a definite time. You see, Nehemiah had used the last 4 months to do some constructive research and planning. He knew very well that decision makers, like kings, CEOs, or whoever, they don't like having to sort through the details themselves. They pay people to do that. If you have an idea, they want to see that you have the initiative to set up a plan that will make it happen. That's a very important lesson for life and I think for ministry. I learned that lesson when I first stepped into a significant kind of role in ministry as an intern in the outreach or missions department at Grace Church just before we came to South Africa some 20 years ago. And when I was in that intern position, I would talk to the missionaries. They would tell me what their problems were, and it was my job to communicate that to the elders and to solve the problems. I learned very quickly that the elders, as godly and gracious men that they were, that they didn't like it very much when I came to an elder meeting and said, "Here's the problem, what should we do?" And when I did that, or the missions pastor and I together did that, they didn't like that very much. They loved it when we came to the meeting and said, "Here's the problem, and here are three possible solutions that we've been able to think of. Based on what we know, we're leaning towards solution number two." Leaders and elders love that sort of thing. Now, because of other information they had, historical background, because of their experience, they often reordered our suggestions, and sometimes they abandoned those three altogether and gave us a fourth. But they were glad that we had put some constructive thought into the whole thing. Nehemiah understood that dynamic perfectly. He'd been on both sides of that table, no doubt. And therefore, he didn't just blurt out the problem to the king and expect the king to do all the thinking and the problem solving for him. Nehemiah outlined the problem and a plan to solve it. I remember when one of the men in our church, I was in Polokwane for the Shepherd's Conference, and we were supposed to fly from Polokwane back down here. And he called me early in the morning and he said, "Joel, the plane is broken. I'm getting in my car now. I'll be there in 2.5 hours. And he hung up. I like that. Oh, I'm glad to know there's a problem, but I'm glad to know there's a plan. I don't have to make the plan. He just told me what the plan is. He'll be here in 2.5 hours. Deal. That's a good lesson for ministry. Such excellence in planning and foresight and trying to think ahead is the mark of a good leader. Plans will often be rearranged, sometimes scrapped altogether, but it's always good to do some preliminary thinking. So Nehemiah in verse 6 gives him a specific time frame. I'll need to be gone this long. Here's what I'm going to do. Now, once he has the king leaning his way, Nehemiah bumps him a little bit. He requests another couple of things that he knows he's going to need in order to succeed. Verse 7. And I said to the king, if it please the king, let letters be given to me for the governors of the provinces beyond the river, that they may allow me to pass through until I come to Judah. And also a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forests, that he may give me timber to make beams for the gates and the fortress which is by the temple, for the wall of the city and for the house to which I will go. King granted them to me because I had planned so well and I had it all listed out and it was, you know, in a spreadsheet and it was only 2 pages and the PowerPoint presentation was flawless and man, it just really was not that at all, was it? The king granted them to me because the good hand of my God was on me. Nehemiah's obvious concern for his people and his very coherent, workable plan, I think that's part of what convinced the king. But really all of that is just another way of saying the good hand of God was upon him. Because we're responsible to prepare and to plan and do all that. But we know in the end, when anything gets done here in Grace Fellowship, in your lives personally, wherever it is, we know that it's because God. It's because God is at work. All of Nehemiah's prayerful preparation, all of his thorough background work would have meant nothing if God had not intervened. Again, you know the Proverbs. Proverbs 21, verse 1. The king's heart is like channels of water in the hand of the Lord. He turns it wherever he pleases. For all of Nehemiah's excellence, it is indeed God's omnipotence and providence that make the difference. So God's good hand is seen in the leader he gives, and it's seen in the success that he gave that leader, Nehemiah, before the king of Persia. Now, having cleared the hurdle of Artaxerxes' permission with God's power boost, with God's assist, Nehemiah, however, has hardly just begun. You see, there are 2 more groups of people that he's going to have to face. He's got the people of Judah that he still has to face, and then the people of the surrounding provinces who are, frankly, the opposition. Neither of those groups is naturally inclined to embrace the goals that Nehemiah has set here. The Jews, they were stuck in the negative inertia of doing nothing, of discouragement and defeat. Having done nothing for the last 15 years or so, it's not going to be easy for Nehemiah to get these people moving. The handbrake is up. Right? This is not going to be an easy car to push out of the sand. The last time they had tried to work on the city, a royal decree had been issued that they must stop and all their work was destroyed. Deep-seated discouragement among the residents of Jerusalem was certainly going to be a roadblock to Nehemiah's civil construction plan. But besides the problem of motivating the workers, Nehemiah knew that he was also going to have to fight off the opposition. You see, the surrounding provinces were benefiting from Judah's weak position. They were taking advantage of that. They were kicking Judah and Jerusalem while they were down. And they weren't going to just then lay down and let Nehemiah kind of walk all over them and build up a strong Judah again. They were going to resist that for their own selfish benefit. And so God has granted Nehemiah success before the king. Now let's see how he grants Nehemiah success before the people and before the opposition. Verse 9. Then I came to the governors of the provinces beyond the river. That's beyond the river Euphrates, so now he's on the south side of that river. And gave them the king's letters. Now the king had sent with me officers of the army and horsemen. Probably having been told by Nehemiah that the provinces around had previously used armed force to interrupt the work, the king says, "Well, Nehemiah, why don't I send a contingent of cavalry with you?" Okay. That makes a nice statement to go along with letters of introduction. "Hi, I'm the new governor of Judah, and by the way, here's the cavalry regiment to back me up." Right? That does make a difference. And such a statement by the king on Nehemiah's behalf was not superfluous. Look at verse 10. "When Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official heard about it, it was very displeasing to them that someone had come to seek the welfare of the sons of Israel." Sanballat was an important leader in Samaria to the north, and perhaps even the governor. We know later on he was the governor. At this point he might have been as well. Tobiah is the governor of the area of Ammon, which is the area across the Jordan River to the east. And these two guys are extremely upset that their power scheme is now going to be upset by Nehemiah, the king's favorite, coming to Jerusalem. The Hebrew literally says, it was displeasing to them a very great evil. They're not happy guys. Well, his credentials established, Nehemiah's first concern now is not the opposition. He needs to motivate the people to get them moving. Now, motivation is probably one of the hardest tasks that any leader faces. And that's especially true in the church where most of the work is done by volunteers. You know, you can't hold a Sunday school teacher's salary over his head to get him to do a better job. It doesn't work that way. In fact, someone suggested once that the average business executive would resign on the spot if you told him that his whole workforce would be totally volunteer and under absolutely no obligation to do anything he said. Yeah, he's just going to resign right there. The money's not worth it. It doesn't matter what you're paying me. Well, that's the kind of situation that Nehemiah faces here. He can't really force anyone to do the work on the wall. I mean, I guess he can line up troops, you know, but that's not going to make for motivated workers. Now, so the first thing that Nehemiah does, once the formalities of his arrival are out of the way, is he makes a tour of inspection. Nehemiah loves to plan. Verse 11. "So I came to Jerusalem and was there 3 days." He also doesn't like to delay very much. He's there 3 days. You know, they have a big feast and all the stuff you got to do when the new governor shows up. But as soon as that's out of the way, now let's get to work. It says, "I arose in the night, and I and a few men with me, I did not tell anyone what my God was putting into my mind to do for Jerusalem, and there was no animal with me except the animal in which I was riding." Cavalry troops, they get left behind, right? They're not on this little trip. "So I went out at night by the valley gate in the direction of the Dragon's Well and on to the refuse gate, inspecting the walls of Jerusalem, which were broken down, and its gates, which were consumed by fire. Then I passed on to the fountain gate and the king's pool, but there was no place for my mount to pass. So I went up at night by the ravine and inspected the wall. Then I entered the valley gate and again and returned. And the officials did not know where I had gone or what I had done, nor had I as yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, or the rest who did the work." So Nehemiah takes this little midnight outing to do some reconnaissance. He is never a man to tackle a serious task without seriously weighing up what it's going to involve. Unfortunately, the situation is as bad or perhaps even worse than has been reported to him. You can't quite see it here if you don't know the geography, but so disorderly are the piles of rubble and debris that he can't even come close to making a complete tour of the walls. The whole wall around the central city, the temple area, and all that is probably about 2 kilometers in circumference. Nehemiah's survey covers only a very small portion of that, and he basically just gives up. Now, you might wonder why he did this reconnaissance secretly in the middle of the night, and I think you can kind of get it from the text. He clearly wants to forestall negative gossip about his plan to rebuild the wall. Because all the cynics would have said if they had found out beforehand, oh, that's impossible, that'll never work, we can't do that. Nehemiah's not going to give them a chance to build up resistance to the plan. He's not going to let them beat him to the punch. So he does his reconnaissance, and then in verse 17, Nehemiah calls a public meeting to address the people. Then I said to them, you see the bad situation that we are in. The Jerusalem is desolate, and its gates are burned by fire. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem so that we will no longer be a reproach. I told them how the hand of my God had been favorable to me, and also about the king's words which he had spoken to me. And then they said, let us arise and build. So they put their hands to the good. I find it fascinating and instructive to consider Nehemiah's approach to motivation. Nehemiah did not make a big show or a big fuss. There's no chanting, no rallies, no posters, no slogans. Follow the call to build the wall or something like that, you know. There's just nothing goofy about Nehemiah. He doesn't promise the first one who finishes their section of the wall will get a brand new chariot or, you know, none of that stuff. I appreciate that. There's no goofiness here. What he does first is he just clearly defines the need in verse 17. You see the bad situation we're in, that Jerusalem is desolate and its gates burned by fire. Half of motivating people is showing them, well, here's the problem. Here's the need. Of course, then he proposes a legitimate solution. Come, he says in verse 17, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem so that we will no longer be a reproach. And as he outlines the problem and the solution to the problem, he works hard to develop a sense of community responsibility. You see the bad situation that we are in. Come, let us rebuild the wall so that we will not be a reproach. People work best when they realize there's a significant task, something is valuable that we can share in together to work on. Nehemiah also deflected one of their possible excuses. Oh, but wait, Nehemiah, the king said that we can't do the work, he says in verse 18. No, we've got permission. I told them what the king had said. And then he ends by encouraging their faith, because it's going to have to be God. I told them how the hand of my God had been favorable to me. Their response when they hear the king has lifted the edict that they can't do any work, they said, well, let's arise and build. Let's get to it. They put their hands to the good work. You see, human manipulation, all that sort of stuff, can get people excited for a short time. Confidence in God will get people excited for a lifetime. Nehemiah built their faith by telling them how God had already worked, how God had gotten royal permission from the king of Persia, how by divine intervention of the God of heaven and earth, they could now build a wall there on their little part of the earth. No matter how good your human excellence, divine omnipotence and providence is always the key. So, without theatrics, without manipulation, Nehemiah motivates the people to work. There's a task that needed to be done, only they can do it, and they can do it if they work together, and if they depend on their God. And of course, Nehemiah's no-nonsense approach stirs them up, and they get to work, verse 18 says. So, God has given success. He's given it with King Artaxerxes, and he's given it with the people. What about the opposition? We met them in verse 10, noted their general and very significant displeasure over Nehemiah's arrival. When they found out that Nehemiah was stirring up the people to rebuild the wall, they laughed in his face. Verse 19. But when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official and Geshem the Arab heard it, they mocked us and despised us and said, what is this thing you are doing? Are you rebelling against the king? Little whisper campaign to discredit Nehemiah. Well, we've met Sanballat and Tobiah. Geshem was an important Arab ruler to the south and the east who covered a wide swath of that area and controlled that. So now there's been mostly a circle around Nehemiah now. A circle of opponents. And their first response is to chide and to mock Nehemiah. And their second response is to blacken his motives. You must be planning a revolt against Persia. You're going to build Judah into your own little kingdom because you got power, you got wealth, and then you're going to revolt against king and try to have your own little, you know, the state of Nehemiah kind of, right, country. Nehemiah has two responses to their mockery. His first response is an expression of faith. His second response is drop dead and get out of here. Verse 20. So I answered them and said, the God of heaven, this is the faith part, the God of heaven will give us success. Therefore, we, his servants, will arise and build. We're trusting God. It looks impossible. We trust God. So we're going to get to it. And then the drop dead part. But you have no portion, right, or memorial in Jerusalem. What are you guys doing here anyway? This is Jewish territory. This is the land of God, of Yahweh, that he has given to the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Bye. Right? And so he sends them packing. The good hand of God has been with Nehemiah all through the process, hasn't it? He planned thoroughly. He planned with great foresight. He didn't go to the king with a vague idea. He went with a well-formulated, workable plan. He carefully analyzed the scope of the task before he jumped into it. He didn't use a lot of superficial tricks and gimmicks to motivate people. He just outlined the need, gave them a workable solution, and said, let's get to it. He drew them together to face the task shoulder to shoulder and encourage their faith in God and God's working. And then he just let the name-calling, the insults, and the false accusations of his enemies just slide right off his back like water off the proverbial duck. All those things are the marks of a great human leader. Human excellence at its highest degree is found in Nehemiah. But the key to it all, by Nehemiah's own admission, is the working of God. Verse 18, I told him how the hand of my God had been favorable to me. You see, Nehemiah 1 and 2 can teach us a lot of very important lessons about leadership and ministry. Nehemiah's passion for God's glory and for people and helping them, his commitment to prayer, his planning, those are all wonderful examples. Straightforward motivation, fearless courage in the face of opposition, that's noble. We can learn volumes from those things. But what Nehemiah teaches us above all else is that it's the good hand of God. There is truly no human excellence that ever matters without divine omnipotence and divine providence. The good hand of my God was upon me. Let's pray. Lord, that's a powerful lesson for us to learn for life and to learn for us as a church here as we, the bottom of Africa here in our own little way, the little circle of influence that you've given us as you allow us to serve you and to impact others individually and as a congregation. That's a great privilege. And Lord, it is an incredible honor for us to do that. And we want to work hard at that. I think we have worked hard at that through the years. We have very hardworking elders. We have very hardworking staff here. We have hardworking congregation members who volunteer wonderfully without a lot of tricks and gimmicks. They work hard. You put the task in front of them and it just gets done. Lord, we rejoice in all of that, and we stand back and say, the good hand of our God. And so we pray, Lord, that you would be at work in us, in our personal sanctification, as we grow in Christ and try to put off sin and put on righteousness, as we work in the workplace, as we love in our families, as we labor in the classroom, whatever it is, Lord, we pray that we would imitate the imitatable things in the life of Nehemiah. There are many, and we pray above all that we too would look at it and say it is the good hand of our God. You get all the glory, because in the end, the work is all yours. We rejoice in the fact that you are an omnipotent, providential God who does his work in us and through us. In Jesus' name, amen.